Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This winter, three Palo Alto, California teenagers took their own lives, and there have been others around the country, too many. The best, the brightest, and the saddest, said one headline. The communities and the school boards affected have started some serious soul-searching. This hour On Point, teenagers in the high cost of success. You can join us on air or online. Have you experienced this in your town? Do you have a teenager who is struggling? What kind of stresses are you seeing? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Madeline Levine, psychologist, author of the books Teach Your Children Well and The Price of Privilege, and co-founder of the Challenge Success Program at Stanford University. Madeline Levine, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, this is a difficult but important topic. You travel around the country, around the world, talking about it. Help us understand the scope of the problem of teen suicide.
Teen suicide is a significant problem. More teenagers die from suicide than from heart disease or cancer or AIDS or the things we more typically think about as being lethal for kids. I actually think it's a bigger issue than just suicide. I think it's a huge mental health issue. We know the greatest predictor of suicide in teenagers is undiagnosed chronic depression. We do very little in the way of screening teens for mental illnesses. You know, we screen for all kinds of things when teenagers are in high school, like they have to have certain vaccinations or they have to take health classes. And yet we do very little about ensuring that they have a reasonable level of mental health.
Well, the numbers are staggering. One in four teenagers now with a clinical diagnosis of depression or anxiety.
Well, this what you're referring to is research of Sunia Luther, who had been at Columbia, now is at Arizona State, who had looked at affluent kids. Nobody had ever looked at affluent kids. There hadn't been a paper until 1999 because the assumption was that these kids were privileged and therefore protected. And it came as quite a shock to find out that on multiple levels, anxiety, depression, substance abuse, psychosomatic disorders, they actually looked much worse than any other group in the United States. And she found a rate of 22% of by the end of high school of girls reporting clinical symptoms of depression. And that was the beginning of looking at some of the problems associated with mental health issues in these high-pressure communities.
So is this a bigger problem then in affluent communities, people with privilege in these epicenters of overachievement, or is it more widespread?
You know, I got to tell you, Jane, because I knew there was the issue of the suicide rates on the reservations. I know you're going to be talking about that later.
Yes.
I started doing some research on it yesterday, and I was appalled and embarrassed that I knew so little about it. The rates of suicide there have been horrendous for decades and decades and decades. I do think that there are particular problems with affluent communities, very particular problems, but I do think suicide is a issue because it's associated with mental illness, because there's stigma around it that impacts almost all communities. And there are specific issues, I think, around affluent communities.
Here's some sound. In January, KCBS's Betty Yu reported on the third teen suicide in 4 months at Palo Alto's Gunn High School.
It's been a tough couple of years for students at Gunn High School, particularly for sophomore Martha Cabot.
It's time we change something.
Seven students have committed suicide since her first day.
Seven students. Here in 2014, a cluster of three teenage suicides in Newton, Massachusetts. This story reported on Chronicle on WCVB.
The city of Newton keeps a close watch after losing three young lives to suicide.
There's an increased likelihood that other adolescents will make an impulsive suicide attempt.
Did Newton's high achievement culture play a role in the death?
In Fairfax, Virginia, three teenage girls committed suicide in the fall of 2014. Here's WJLA's Allison Starling reporting.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now investigating several suicides in Fairfax County. Three teenage girls have killed themselves since just September.
And a story, of course, in the New York Times recently described this horrible scene where you are there, Madeline Levine in Palo Alto. People in orange vests monitoring the railroad tracks at all hours of the day and night, looking for kids who have the intention of stepping out in front of a train to take their own life. I think the Palo Alto Weekly referred to the deaths as suicide contagions. Give us a sense of what this has been like in your community.
You have one of the most desperate communities probably in America right now, trying to figure out what the problem has been and what can be done to solve it. Suicide clusters become difficult to stop once they begin. So there are huge issues of why a community like this, you know, again, where people assume the protective factors of money and education are going to be protective of children. But in fact, in communities like this, there are significant pressures. There are significant academic pressures. There are a significant amount of competition. Kids feel because they have all these resources, they're supposed to be sort of at the top of their class. There's very little room for the normal developmental tasks of adolescence, and I think that's part of the problem, that teenagers are supposed to do a whole bunch of things, only one of which is succeed academically. They're also supposed to make friends. They're also supposed to get used to their new bodies, learn how to talk to the opposite sex. And I think because there is so much scheduling, so much emphasis on extracurricular activities, that the amount of time that's necessary to learn coping skills, to figure out decision making, which is implicated, poor decision making is implicated in suicide. Just to figure out what kind of person you're going to be going forward, the time for that essential work, that foundational work of adolescence, I think has been squeezed out in this thing that Duke has identified, Duke University, as effortless perfection. You're supposed to be great. You're supposed to be good at everything, and good is not good enough. You're supposed to be great at everything. That's just not the way people work. And so it's very important to me, Jane, that it be understood that underneath this, while this may be a trigger, you know, people say, oh, we had no idea the kid got a poor grade or, you know, didn't get into Harvard or whatever, that underneath this, 90% of the time there is a emotional problem, often an undiagnosed emotional problem. And so while it's easy to say there's too much homework, kids don't commit suicide because there's too much homework. Too much homework, a failed test, a breakup in a relationship are trigger events. But without this underlying depression, usually comorbid with something else like anxiety or substance abuse, most kids, you know, don't kill themselves because they have too much homework. And I think we're looking at the symptoms instead of the root causes. Mm.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University and author of the book Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Larry Steinberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
I'm okay. This is such a difficult topic. Has it always been this way to your mind, or what's different now? Why are we hearing about this now?
Well, I think that these well-publicized cluster suicides have understandably brought the problem to the public's attention in a way that doesn't ordinarily happen. That's a good thing that we're paying attention to it. The suicide rate in the United States among teenagers has been rising. But as Madeline Levine said earlier, that's just really the tip of the problem. If you look at statistics on depression, on suicidal ideation, that is just thinking about committing suicide, it is enormously prevalent among American kids. And American kids in a lot of international surveys turn out to be among the most miserable in the world. Now, it is not, I don't think, a problem of academic pressure per se. There are countries where academic pressure on teenagers is much, much greater than it is in the United States, and yet the suicide rate among teenagers is lower, for example, in Korea or in Japan.
So what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a combination of stress, and academic pressure is one type of stress, and a lack of support. And that ought to be part of what we're talking about, because one of the most important predictors of kids' mental health is the connection that they feel with their parents. And I think we've gotten ourselves into a situation now where parents are, at the same time they're micromanaging their children's lives, they're not connected with them emotionally. And I think that it's the combination of feeling that you have no one to turn to and being under stress that is the problem.
Madeline Levine, that is a very difficult combination, though.
Well, hi, Larry.
Hi,
I think most of the research is pretty clear, and a lot of this comes from Dr. Luther's original research, that there is this combination of high stress, high academic pressure, and disconnection from parents, which, frankly, high-achieving parents often find difficult to grasp. Like, they get the academic pressure part more easily. The lack of connection is like, what do you mean? You know, I take my kid to soccer and I take my kid to prep courses and I take my kids to all kinds of things, but that's not the same as connection. I always talk about connection as an inviting, listening presence. And having raised three kids in a competitive community, I know that racing around from activity to activity, usually to, you know, up their capacity or their application for college, has nothing to do with real connection. And I think Dr. Steinberg's exactly right that in addition to mental health services, this whole issue of how we're connected to our children and the fact that we're so incredibly busy. Parents themselves are so stressed and
we're modeling it for our children. Yes.
Absolutely.
Madeline Levine, Larry Steinberg, please hold. We're talking about teenage suicides and soul-searching conversations around this country. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about pushing, not crushing, our children, about the actual tools our kids need to be successful in this highly competitive, rapidly changing world. Here's the trailer to the 2010 documentary Race to Nowhere, where kids talk about all the pressure that's put on them.
I can't really remember the last time I had a chance to go in the backyard and just run around.
School's just so much pressure that every day I would wake up dreading it.
I'm afraid that our children are going to sue us for stealing their childhoods.
With us this hour, Madeline Levine, psychologist and co-founder of the Challenge Success Program at Stanford University, and with Lauren Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. Dr. Steinberg, you say that in communities around this country, demands are being placed on kids that are exceeding their psychological resources. You're an expert in adolescent brain development. What do teenagers need most developmentally at this age?
Well, I think they need to grow up in an environment where there's appropriate challenge, but support that's there to help meet those challenges. I was giving a talk not long ago at Harvard, and in the audience was a mother, and she brought her son with her. I think he was about 13 years old or so. And when I finished speaking about what is good for the adolescent brain, the boy raised his hand and he said, "How do you draw the line between challenge and stress?" And I think we've crossed the line now in what we're expecting teenagers to do, from challenge into stress, and it's taxing kids' emotional and intellectual resources. As Dr. Levine said earlier in this program, adolescents need time to unwind. They need time when their lives are not structured and not directed by adults. And if a teenager is in school from 8 until 3 in the afternoon and then tied up with some sort of structured extracurricular activity every day until 6 and then doing 4 hours of homework a night, that teenager does not have enough time to just kick back and relax. And that's very important for adolescent development.
Dr. Levine, isn't there a lot of doublespeak from parents and school administrators about wanting students to be happy, about wanting kids to be healthy and resilient, but still expecting so much?
Right. That was Matt Ritzel's point in Push, Don't Crush. I think that's important. I think this, if I can go back just for a minute around this issue of connection, because I think it's tied to it. I think the kind of connection kids feel with their parents is based almost, well, I don't know, almost entirely, but largely on performance. And often in my office, a kid will say to me, I'm only as good as my last performance. And this doesn't have to be that the mom says, oh, I'm so disappointed in your performance. It can be a turned back. It can be a raised eyebrow. I think we're constantly communicating our values to our kids. And nobody wants to feel that they're only as good as their last performance. And so I think one of the best things a kid ever said to me in my office was, you know, parents can say all kinds of things, but I know what matters to my mother because when I walk through that door, the first thing she says to me is, how'd you do on your math test? And it's a dead giveaway. It's not, how are you feeling? Or would you like a glass of milk? Or how'd the day go? Kids say the first thing that they're told when they get home is all they need to know about what their parents value. And all this other stuff about, I just want you to be happy, which, by the way, is secondary to me. I think I'm far less interested in kids' quote happiness and far more interested in their sense of meaning and purpose, and not constantly being competitive with each other, but being collaborative, which is what the workforce is saying is needed anyway. Nobody wants to be judged on their performance all the time.
You say we're paying too much attention to happiness. You also talk about letting kids have successful failure, in your words, having kids fail at things in small ways. Why?
Right.
Why?
Because I see the ability to deal with challenge as something that we need to develop in appropriately titrated way. So in other words, a young child who takes a few steps and falls down, we encourage them to get up again, and we don't, you know, threaten them by saying, if you keep falling down again, you're going to be flipping burgers at McDonald's. We totally get that a young child has to fall. And I think, you know, ultimately, I ask every audience I speak to how many people have not had a tragedy, a financial reverse, a divorce. And the number of people in my audience is always zero who have not faced challenge in life. So how do you get a kid to face challenge? You give them appropriate challenges along the way, and you don't bail them out. So, you know, you encourage the 2-year-old to get up again or the 18-month-old to get up again, and your kid leaves his homework on the table at home. Do you run up to school with it? Preferably not, because while the kid's going to be upset and you're going to be upset, it's manageable. And it's exactly in that space that kids learn how to manage dysphoria, unhappy feelings. And one of the things I feel about suicide is these kids are poor decision makers. They have poor self-control, which teenagers do in general, but more than that. And they have very few coping skills for dealing with challenge. And that's the arena I think we need to be focusing on more than these, you know, come in and have a counselor talk to the kids about suicide. I think we need to focus on the root causes.
A lot of listeners contributing to this conversation from our website. One listener says, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? Although I have my doubts, I tried to commit suicide due to the high expectations thrust upon me by myself and others in high school. Ever since that attempt, it's forced me to contemplate life, the nature of expectations, and what makes people happy in a very deep manner. Let's go to Joseph in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joseph. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I couldn't agree more with many of the things your guest is saying, but two aspects. One is I think we've the homework thing, the time spent, the social pressure. There's never been a study, not once, that indicated that homework has any beneficial academic value. Let's start by scrapping it for everything other than long-term projects that children help design themselves as part of the homework, which studies show is useful. But the other thing that I want to ask about and have them take a look at is, we have children today with no perspective, no historical perspective whatsoever, because they don't read books. And because they don't read books, forget television, this is impossible to generate this kind of awareness. They don't know that someone might have experienced these difficulties before. They don't know that someone went through suffering similar to theirs. And they think that they're the only ones that have ever encountered this. I lived for a time in Massachusetts, and Fitchburg, Massachusetts was the suicide capital briefly, with 7 suicides in a short period of time. And none of these kids committed suicide over anything that you would consider to be a huge issue. Like she says, they're trigger events, but they're not real events. They're a missed test. They're a girlfriend that broke up with me. But we give them nothing from historical perspective to base this on. 10 days in Kathmandu would radically open up the eyes of every high school student in America. No food, no water, and the government that's supposed to be helping you is often your enemy.
Joseph, thank you. Larry Steinberg, would you respond?
Well, I think that the issue is not whether kids have homework or not. The issue is whether what we're asking our teenagers to do is developmentally appropriate for them. There's a term that psychologists use called scaffolding. It's like the titrating that Dr. Levine was talking about before. And that's giving people challenges that are within their reach, that push them to do a little bit more than what they have been capable of doing in the past, but not so much that they're going to be overwhelmed by it. And I think that that is a big part of the problem. I do agree with the caller's emphasis on helping kids put various kinds of life events into perspective. Mm-hmm. But who's going to help them do that? Who's going to suggest what they ought to read? A lot of that perspective that kids need to gain comes out of intimate conversations with their parents. And if their parents are just paying attention to their test scores or the grades they get in school and not connecting with their kids emotionally, they're not helping their children form the kind of perspective that this caller is correct in saying kids need to be able to do.
Let's go to Montgomery, Alabama. Michelle is on the line. Michelle, I'm so glad you called. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have several questions, but my biggest one is, you know, I have a son who committed suicide 6 years ago. He was 19 when he passed away. And he graduated high school with honors, had no problems in high school. He was an ROTC student, went into the Navy, had some issues with separation anxiety. I guess as parents we go through empty nest syndrome, but he went through like this severe separation anxiety and came home, and we had him committed. And a week after he got out of the hospital, he laid down in front of a train. Mm. I feel like I did everything I was supposed to do. I looked out to the resources that I had. I knew something was wrong with him. I had him committed. And still, you know, 1 week later, after leaving the hospital, there was no signs at all that he was going to do this. Had breakfast with a friend at 8:30 in the morning, was seen walking up to the train tracks at 9:30, and laid down and waited for the train for an hour. Mm. So I'm just wondering, you know, as parents, what are our resources that might be available to us that if we see something or hear something or feel something's wrong with our children, what are the resources? I mean, he was 19, so I kept getting he's an adult, you know?
Michelle, thank you very much. I'm so sorry for your family, and I really appreciate the courage to call. Dr. Levine, would you respond to that? Do you hear that often from parents who say, I didn't see this coming? There were no clues.
Yeah, again, Michelle, thank you, and sorry for your loss. I do hear that, but, you know, Michelle was brave enough to point out that her son had been hospitalized, that he did have significant problems. And we do find that there is a spike in suicide right after hospitalization. You know, hindsight is 20/20. So people will say all kinds of things about what we should have done. And I think it leaves parents with a tremendous sense of guilt that they didn't pick something up. You know, kids are very good at hiding things, and particularly kids in affluent communities where looking good is incredibly important. It's important to the parents. It's important to the schools. I think one of the most disturbing things, and I'm sure Dr. Steinberg has found the same thing, it was very easy to tell a depressed kid 20 years ago. It is not so easy now because they have learned the social skill that we all seem to value, which is not being vulnerable, never showing weakness, not being close enough to talk about what they're really going through. And, I mean, I think those are just some of the issues that we need to address. And frankly, I think that the emphasis on what's going on in these affluent communities in some ways takes us away from, because they're jazzy and they make the headlines, and, you know, we sort of know the impact of the media on suicide clusters, takes us away from the kinds of things Dr. Steinberg is talking about, which is understanding the adolescent brain, what it needs, and meeting developmental needs.
Let's go to Tastin in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Tastin. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I totally agree with everything that's been said. I graduated high school in 2011, and, you know, it's not that I was pushed to do anything, so that I was expected to do things. I was always a smart young man, and I mean, if I ever got anything below with, you know, what I was capable of, I was always told, you know, let known. And, you know, to be 16, 17 years old, going to school from 7:30 to 3, you know, going to work from 4 to 10:30, and then expected to do 4 hours of homework and, you know, advanced placement classes and honors classes. You know, how exactly does that benefit a 16-year-old, 17-year-old?
Yeah.
You know, not being able to spend time with your friends who you think are the only people that can identify with you. Mm-hmm. And I mean, eventually I turned to substance abuse. And when I got into college, my grades bombed. I wound up getting arrested. I had to go to a treatment program because I was, you know, using intravenous drugs because I felt like that was my only, you know, chance to escape from everything that was going on in my life.
Tastin, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Levine, is this often a path you see from high expectations to depression, anxiety, and then substance abuse?
Yeah, but you know, I think Chasson gave a nice little description of what a crazy lifestyle that is for a young teenager. And here's the reality. In communities like this, that he's describing, there's this expectation that kids are going to be really terrific at everything. You know, they're going to be straight-A students, great boards, terrific college acceptances, leaders, heads of the lacrosse team, on and on and on. And what I think is almost bizarre about that, frankly, is that none of us are good at everything, period. This is easy for me. I can get on and talk. I can talk and I can write. I couldn't find my way around the block if you know, I needed to. So there are things that all of us are good at, and it's only a few things. And there are things that we're mediocre at, and there are things, quite frankly, that we all suck at, right? But we don't allow that reality to the children. So, you know, I will often get a call from a mother who says, well, I know I shouldn't call you, but my daughter has 4 A's and a C. And I know what she's calling about. So, you know, it's like, what's the C in? Oh, it's in chemistry. Does your daughter like chemistry? No, she doesn't like it at all. Well, it's like, guess what? She's not going to be a chemist. So why don't we pay attention to the things that she's good at and forget about the C? Because in life, we all go to our right. We go to our strengths. And as adults, we're not good at everything, and kids are not good at everything. And this expectation of being extraordinary at everything you do is just kind of crazy, frankly.
Hi, everyone. Tom here. The On Point podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Here at the show, we interview many book authors, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, bestsellers or lesser-known but equally important titles. We love making you aware. Now, Audible.com is helping make books even more accessible, allowing you to listen to great titles whenever and wherever you want. They offer 180,000 titles, and right now, On Point listeners can get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. You can get started today.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about managing our teenagers' mental health and giving them the tools they need to thrive in the highly competitive, ever-changing world. William Derezowitz is the author of last year's book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite. He wrote about how the cutthroat competition to get into America's best schools produces students who are overscheduled and unimaginative. When he came on this program in August, he described the long list of accomplishments that the Yale admissions office looks for in its successful applicants.
You need 10 or 12 extracurriculars. You need 7 or 8 AP courses. You need to demonstrate service, leadership, musical instrument, sports equipment, foreign travel, great college essay based on some spectacular experience you had.
With me this hour, Joanne Levine, psychologist and co-founder of the Challenge Success Program at Stanford University, and Lawrence Steinberg, professor of psychology at Temple University. John is in Berkshire, Vermont. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, guest. Yeah, I think there's a giant disconnect here between the role models that parents are portraying are oftentimes completely distracted by these technologies. There's a slew of evidence now by science that's showing that all these social media connections, these technologies that we have now, it's not a human connection, right? I mean, technology is the engine, but humanity is the rudder of human progress. And kids look up to these parents who are completely distracted, or adults in general, and just gunning for just jobs, but not enrichment, you know? Mm-hmm. T.S. Eliot said, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? And with all this information, kids don't know where to turn. They want to see enrichment, and they want to see true accomplishment.
John, thank you very much. Larry Steinberg, talk a little bit about that, the technological distractions, the social media expectations in our kids' lives today.
Well, I think it's just another source of disconnect between kids and the people in their lives who ought to be paying attention to their feelings. You know, it's not just the kids who are on social media, it's their parents. And you can just envision many of these families trying to have what they think of as a family dinner when everybody at the dinner table has their smartphone out and is texting and surfing on the internet while they're eating instead of talking to each other and having genuine conversations. But there's a topic, Jane, that I think we ought to raise, because okay. I'm sure that lots of parents who are listening are wondering what signs they should be looking for that their kid is in trouble psychologically. So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, as a rule of thumb, if your child's behavior seems to have changed in some important ways in terms of how your child has been performing in school, whether your child is engaging in or withdrawing from friendships and social relationships, whether it looks like your child might be using alcohol or illegal drugs, and you notice that this change in your child's personality and functioning has persisted for 2 weeks, that's a pretty good rule of thumb, you ought to seek some professional help. And I know one of the callers before asked, well, what do we do? Where do we go? Your child's school ought to be able to refer you to a mental health professional in your community who specializes in working with teenagers. If not that, then your family physician probably can be another good resource to turn to. So it is important to pay attention to the signs that your teenager may be showing you, but not talking to you about immediately.
Thank you very much, Dr. Steinberg. Dr. Levine, how do you teach kids resilience? We hear there are the signs, what to look for if you're a parent. How do you go about teaching kids self-control, resilience, grit, you know, these important lifelong skills that really are very important?
Well, so you have – that goes back to the issue of failure. I just read last night in the Wall Street Journal that this generation is more afraid of failure than any generation before. And as a result, they have the lowest rates of starting their own businesses, which is kind of surprising given my being down in Silicon Valley. But this was national. So I think the way you do that essentially is you have kids wait. Self-control, you know, everybody knows the marshmallow study.
Yeah.
Kids who waited to have their marshmallows, you know, years and years later did better in school, had better self-control and better relationships. So, you know, your kid says, I want ice cream now. And it's like, okay, I get that. We can't have it right now. We're waiting 5 minutes. Or I want my car now. You know, they turn 16 and all of a sudden a car shows up in the driveway. No, they have to work for it. They have to wait for it. So I think, again, it's implemented in small escalating amounts of self-control. And I want to add, if you don't mind, to this point,
please,
that Dr. Steinberg raised, that we need to know what to look for. And, you know, if I talk to parents, they pin these issues on the school. If I talk to the school, they pin the issues on the parents. If I happen to talk to schools and administration and faculty together, they pin it on the universities. The fact is our whole culture has become more materialistic, more narcissistic, more competitive, and probably more than anything else, we've had a bifurcation of wealth. And along with this bifurcation of wealth, you have parents who are extremely anxious that if life in the United States is a zero-sum game, that their kid's either going to be a winner or a loser. And so I don't want to leave the program with the feeling that parents are simply miserable with their kids now. I don't think that's the case. But I think we've had a big cultural shift that also plays into some of the problems we're seeing.
Here's Ruthie in Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruthie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My issue's a little different. My son is a white boy from Northern European descent. We are not immigrants. He goes to a high school where most of his friends are 77 first languages. Most of his friends are first-generation immigrants. Their parents struggled a lot to get here. His one friend was at my house on Sunday. Not this last Sunday, this was 2 years ago, and on Tuesday she killed herself. She is a first-generation immigrant from a poor family where her folks work three jobs. They want a better life for their families. And I'm just wondering how I, as an ally to that immigrant community, can support those children.
Dr. Steinberg, Ruthie, thank you.
Well, you know, stress doesn't discriminate among people from different backgrounds. Any child can be under stress, and stress is one of the things that can trigger suicide in adolescence, as it can in adulthood. Certainly, the challenges facing kids whose families have recently arrived in the United States, where parents may not speak English, where the kids may not be fluent English speakers, are very, very large and sometimes enormous. However, that said, what the research on this tells us is something that has been called the immigrant paradox, which is, oddly enough, immigrant children in this country have better mental health than kids whose families have lived here for several generations. So I wouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that because a child comes from an immigrant household, that that child is at special risk. In fact, there may be some very strong protective factors in immigrant households that have to do with close family relationships.
As we finish up here in our last couple of minutes, Madeline Levine, what's your message to parents, to educators, to children themselves, to kids themselves about what we're discussing here?
You know, that there is enough research that tells us that the school you go to is nowhere near as significant as parents think, that the majority of CEOs in this country, just like
myself, I'm not a CEO, went to state schools, that it's the kid, not the school, that, that makes for success, and that there is a whole range of coping skills that once you're out in the world matter more than any grade you ever got. You know, can you communicate? Can you work in a group? Do you have friends? Are you social? Are you collaborative? And I think we are at great risk ignoring those things which are the business community are saying are absolutely essential going forward in a world that's, you know, kind of volatile and uncertain and ambiguous. We should have SEL, socio-emotional learning, in every school because poor decision-making obviously is a large part of suicide. Yeah. We should have screening in every school. We should direct some of our resources to the mental health of our students, not just the technology in the classroom and a bunch of other things, you know, big gyms and all this kind of stuff. We need better mental health services.
I have about 15 seconds. Larry Steinberg, your final word here.
I guess the final word is for all of us to stop judging adolescents solely by their achievement in school and start thinking about what kids need to grow up healthy and happy in life.
Madeline Levine, Lauren Steinberg, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll look to another shocking teenage suicide cluster in another part of the country, this time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. That's coming up in just a minute. This is On Point. Since December, the Pine Ridge Reservation, home of the Oglala Sioux tribe in South Dakota, has been the scene of a heartbreaking crisis. Nine people between the ages of 12 and 24 have taken their lives. Nine people. Joining me now from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to discuss this is Regina Garcia-Cano, reporter for the Associated Press, who's been covering the Pine Ridge Reservation story. Regina, thanks so much for your time.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, tell me what's been happening there on Pine Ridge. What's to account for this?
Well, since mid-December, there have been nine recorded suicides in the reservation. Seven of them were teenagers, and the youngest one of them was 12 years old. And when you talk with the tribal leaders, parents, teachers, you know, they all point at a few things, which are the bullying, primarily on social media, as well as some of the hopelessness that, you know, you can see in a reservation where there's a high poverty rate, with high unemployment rate as well. Mm-hmm. And they also point at the decimation of their own culture.
So nine suicides in the last period of time. Many more youth on the reservation have tried but failed to kill themselves, as I understand it here. At least 103 attempts by people 12 to 24 between December and March. How has the community responded here?
Well, the community is it has responded in different ways. In one way, parents have come together to have meetings where they talk about what they can do to help the children. One of them is, well, one of the things that they were thinking about doing is, well, paying a little bit more attention to their children, see if there are any, you know, cues that point at, you know, maybe the children not going through some difficult time and finding ways to talk with them. They are also trying to have a mass naming ceremony where each kid will get a Lakota name as a way to give them, you know, an identity and teach them about their culture. They're also bringing mental health counselors from different parts of the country to go to schools, talk with students, talk with teachers, and teach them how to communicate about, you know, stress as well mm-hmm. as suicide. Mm.
So communication, talking about identity issues. What are the mental health resources available to this community on the Sioux Reservation?
Sure. So in Pine Ridge, there are nine full-time counselors, and they're there through the Indian Health Service, IHS. And what happened was when tribal leaders realized that this was a serious situation, they declared a state of emergency, and that allowed them to ask the U.S. Public Health Service to send in groups of volunteers who are licensed counselors to go to schools and talk with children, teachers, parents.
This is a community already overwhelmed, as you said, with high rates of unemployment and poverty and domestic abuse and alcohol addiction. Could you talk a little bit about the plan moving forward beyond mental health resources? What are people doing to put an end to this?
You know, when I talk with a few suicide prevention outreach workers, they said that this is an ongoing problem in a reservation. They've had similar situations in the past. So what they're trying to do is teach children how to communicate about suicide. So if they hear one of their friends talking about, you know, that they're stressed or maybe considering ending their lives, then go to a teacher or go to a trusted adult and tell them, hey, this is what my friend just told me. They're really trying to teach children and parents about how to communicate about this issue and not see it just as a taboo or, you know, something that you just shouldn't talk about. It's really a lot about communication, what they're trying to do moving forward.
Regina Garcia Cano, Associated Press reporter from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I really appreciate your time, Regina. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast listeners at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Jilly Jopp, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Pratt, and James Ross, with help from Sarah Baker, Hillary McQuilkin, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, Anthony Doerr just won the Pulitzer Prize for his best-selling book, All the Light We Cannot See. He will join us. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being here. This is On Point.